May it please the Court?
Sure.
The sole issue on appeal in Mr. Sanders' case is whether or not the trial court created reversible error when it did not sustain a timely request to instruct the jury on the lesser included offense of involuntary manslaughter. The jury was instructed on murder in the second degree, voluntary manslaughter, along with self-defense, and ultimately convicted Mr. Sanders of murder in the second degree. There are two different ways that the trial court was required to give the timely instruction. One was under statute section 556.042, and the other basis was under existing case law as well as the more recent cases of Jackson and Pierce and his progeny. I think the state would agree that Mr. Sanders met the first two requirements under the statute, that a timely request is made and that it's given in proper form. That the timely request was made. I think his first argument is with the language of the proposed instruction. The state's argument is that because Mr. Sanders' proposed instruction had the language that he recklessly caused Ms. Hill's death by kicking her, as opposed to the language of kicking and strangling her, which was in the first two instructions for murder and for voluntary manslaughter, that the instruction was not given in proper form. This argument easily fails. For one thing, the jury was not required to believe that she had been strangled at all or that Mr. Sanders was the person that had strangled her. Based on his own testimony and the testimony of the eyewitness in the room, there was a basis to believe that Mr. Sanders had recklessly caused Ms. Hill's death by kicking her. And really, not including that one or those two words in the instruction lessened the state's burden because it didn't have to prove that Mr. Sanders had strangled her in order to convict him of recklessly causing her death. But in any event, there was a basis in the evidence to acquit him of murder in the second degree and voluntary manslaughter, and to convict him of recklessly causing her death by kicking her. There was substantial evidence of that presented at the trial through his own testimony and through that of the eyewitness in the room. I would also argue that involuntary manslaughter is a nested, lesser-included offense of both voluntary manslaughter and a murder in the second degree. A lesser-included offense that is separated only by the mental state or the mens rea is a nested, lesser-included offense. So similarly to the case of Randall and Roberts, which involved assault cases, finding that assault in the third degree is a nested, lesser-included offense of assault in the second degree, and domestic assault in the third degree is a nested, lesser-included offense of domestic assault in the second degree, so is involuntary manslaughter a nested, lesser-included offense of both voluntary manslaughter and murder in the second degree, and that the only difference between these three charges is the mental state. Ultimately, Mr. Sanders caused her death. The question before the jury would be whether or not that was knowing or under the influence of sudden passion or recklessly. And under section 562.021, if someone acts knowingly, they automatically also act recklessly. So given these facts, given the timely request, pattern after the Missouri approved instructions, given the evidence, given the statute, and given this court's recent line of cases, the trial court committed error when it did not grant the timely instruction, or the timely request to instruct the jury on involuntary manslaughter. Much of the state's brief and argument I am anticipating will be about prejudice and whether or not Mr. Sanders suffered prejudice.
And the standard for review, if you would please address that also.
The standard for review is de novo. So this court would review that de novo.
Whether it's a presumption of prejudice or a determination of prejudice.
And under Jackson, if the requirements are met, it's prejudice is presumed. And the only way to be consistent with the holdings of both Jackson and Pierce and the recent cases that have followed those cases is to presume prejudice. This court has consistently said, especially of late, that it is always the jury who decides every fact. and that it won't speculate as to what a jury should think or should find or what reasonable inferences to draw. That is always left to the province of the jury. There is no way for this court to determine prejudice without doing exactly that. You would have to look at the facts in the record and decide which ones you thought were important, what you thought a jury was thinking, what inference a jury would draw, what a jury would think about recklessness. And to do that would be to run counter to Jackson and Pierce, which again, leave every fact and every inference to be drawn from every fact to the jury or to the finder of fact. There is just no way to weigh prejudice without speculating and without substituting the court's judgment for what the jury would do. And
do you think it's, are you saying it's an irrebuttable presumption, or that it may be rebuttable but you can't rebut it by reweighing the evidence for the jury? It would have to be some other mechanism.
My argument would be that it is not rebuttable, that it's just presumed.
What if you submitted a lesser that did test the same mens rea as the one that was rejected?
If it tested the same mens rea, it's hard to imagine what lesser would test the exact same mens rea. That might be a different case. I know in Mr. Sanders' case, the main issue that was never decided by a jury was whether or not he acted recklessly. And they decided whether or not he acted knowingly or under the influence of sudden passion, but whether or not he acted recklessly was never determined. And a jury could have believed that based on the evidence presented. It could have believed that he was acting in self-defense because the eyewitness in the room agreed that a knife had been pulled on him multiple times. And it might have thought that he had the right to defend himself, the jury, but that he didn't have the right to use the amount of force that he did. It might have also believed that he was reckless in kicking her so many times and leaving her in a vulnerable state on the landing.
What was a self-defense instruction given in this case? I can't remember.
It was.
And so they could have found that the force used in self-defense was unreasonable.
Correct. Okay. And I think this case is very similar to State v. Frost, which is a 2001 case out of the Western District, which is still good law. In that case, the victim was ultimately killed by a woman that he was repeatedly making sexual advances towards. She kept fending him off, and eventually stabbed him. She was convicted of murder in the second degree. The jury was instructed on both murder and voluntary manslaughter and convicted her of murder in the second degree. In that case, the state made the same argument that there was no prejudice because she was convicted of the higher offense, and the jury opted not to convict her of the lesser offense. And in that case, the Western District held that because the element of recklessness was never tested by that jury, that she did in fact suffer prejudice and a new trial was required. Because no jury had ever determined whether or not she had acted recklessly in stabbing the victim in that case, or whether or not she had acted in self-defense but had used an unreasonable amount of force. This court should continue to support the fundamental holdings of Jackson and its progeny, which, again, only a jury can ultimately decide whether or not Mr. Sanders acted recklessly on that day. And unless there are any other questions.
Any other questions?
This side's going to talk about Rule 28. You want to talk about that at all?
About Rule 28.
Rule 28, judicially determining prejudice.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your
judicially line. Determining prejudice.
I think if you look at Jackson and its progeny, it's clear that prejudice is presumed. And I think to really be consistent, that should remain the case. Even if this court found that it's rebuttable, I don't think it's rebutted in this case because there was so much evidence put on that supported recklessness. If the jury believed Mr. Sanders' testimony in part, it could have believed he acted recklessly. Or if it believed the witness and some combination of Mr. Sanders, ultimately, there was substantial evidence presented at trial by the defense to support a finding of recklessness. Unlike maybe other cases where no affirmative evidence is put on, there actually was affirmative evidence put on by the defense to support that instruction and to support a jury finding that. And even if there wasn't, I think Jackson is clear that no affirmative defense is necessary. That is, by pleading not guilty and going to trial, a defendant is automatically challenging the state's case.
The state appears to be arguing that there's a conflict between a presumption of prejudice and the requirement that prejudice be judicially determined. Is there an inherent conflict with the determination by the judge as to whether or not there was prejudice precludes a consideration of whether there's a presumption?
I think this court often presumes prejudice. I think that is a judicial determination of prejudice in itself, is that it's presumed. And I don't find that to be an inherent conflict. And I think it would run counter to the more recent line of cases before this court.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the court?
Sir.
The state's argument to begin is not that the instruction was not in proper form, but that the instruction was submitted a different type of causation, the proffered instruction for involuntary manslaughter in first degree. The defendant's proffered instruction was that he caused the death of the victim recklessly by kicking her. The state's causation was that he both kicked and strangled the victim and thereby caused her death knowingly. Now,
Is kicking a subset of kicking and strangling?
I think it is. I mean, just factually, it's a subset. But I think it does change the analysis in a couple of important respects. First, I think it changes the analysis on the third point of whether the trial court was obligated to instruct down. Arguably, there was no direct evidence that kicking alone caused the victim's death. The expert in this case testified that it was blunt force trauma and the strangulation.
Yeah, but then you've got Jackson, which says the jury can believe any part of the evidence and or not believe any of it at all, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And with regard to the expert's testimony, I suppose they could have looked at the expert's testimony and said, well, the expert said it was by blunt force trauma and strangulation. You could disbelieve that, but that doesn't necessarily create evidence expert testimony that it was caused by kicking.
But we said you don't need affirmative evidence. You can just disbelieve.
Sure. And if you disbelieve the evidence of causation, then I'm not sure that evidence remains that he killed her by kicking her alone. Now, there was testimony that he brutally kicked her repeatedly, and a lay witness in the room said that, you know, she thought that she breathed her last gasp. And so arguably that could be relied on by a jury as opposed
that
to...
That plus the expert testimony that kicking was a...
It was part of it.
Right,
yes.
Part of the causation.
Right. And so, you know, and that's why I ultimately concede that while arguably there's a basis to support the lesser, even if it's not reasonably probable under my view of the evidence, perhaps the trial court should have given it. Now, that's just the first way that the different causation is important in this case. The second way that it becomes important is when the court looks at whether there was prejudice. And with regard to prejudice, Rule 2802F says that with regard to error in giving of these sorts of instructions, the prejudicial effect of those errors should be judicially determined. Now, it's true that in Jackson, the court said in a footnote, well, in many instances, we don't reverse for instructional error unless there's some reasonable probability of a different result. But some prior cases have also said we presume prejudice, so we're not going to reconcile what appears to be an absence of
prejudice. Well, it said we presume prejudice.
Yes, absolutely.
Period. We'd have to reverse that. We'd have to overturn that.
Well, I think not in this case for two reasons, and I'll jump ahead to that, which is simply that Jackson was not a two-down case. And when I say two-down, I mean Jackson was...
No, that's a different issue of whether you've rebutted the presumption. But it said you presume prejudice.
Well, that's true. I understand. I apologize, Your Honor. I think I misunderstood your question. Yes, I think that the court would need to back away from the line of cases that say we presume prejudice without any analysis in these cases.
But that means overturning a very recent decision.
Yeah, I think it means taking up what the court decided it wouldn't reconcile in Jackson. In the footnote, it said we don't need to reconcile this apparent discrepancy between these lines of cases because we've presumed prejudice in the past and we're going to presume prejudice
here.
Well,
opposing counsel suggests they're not inconsistent, that this court has judicially determined that in this type of situation where you fail to give a nested offense, which you're entitled to, and which the jury could find, that we judicially determine you can presume prejudice. It would, in other words, it would be an abuse of discretion not to find prejudice in every case, so we presume it.
That's certainly true. The court could look at it and say, in this particular situation, there is a presumption of prejudice. We're going to presume prejudice and call that a judicial determination of prejudice without regard to any of the facts in the case. The court could do that.
But that still leaves the second issue, which is, has it been rebutted or can it be rebutted?
I agree. And frankly, I think the court should move away from the language of presuming prejudice. There are very few types of errors where the court actually presumes prejudice and finds that, you know, that the prejudice is, you know, automatic. Most of the time, courts engage in a prejudice analysis, look at the facts of the case, and determine whether, on balance, the defendant was deprived of a fair trial. And I would encourage the court to do that in this situation, because this instructional error doesn't appear to be significantly different from other types of trial court errors that might affect the outcome of the trial.
And how are you going to overcome, how are you going to determine prejudice as a judge without reweighing the evidence for the jury?
I think that, weighing the evidence certainly is something the court shouldn't do on the first half of the analysis on whether the trial court erred, whether the trial court should have given the instruction. As the court stated in Jackson, that's not the judge's job. Only the jury can make that determination. And so absolutely, I think the court has made plain in Jackson, and I've conceded that in several briefs before the court today, that only the jury makes that determination. And so on the issue of whether there was error, whether the instruction should have been given, you don't weigh. But prejudice doesn't take place in the same vacuum that the analysis of error takes
place. But you're asking us to undertake the same factual analysis just at a later point and say, yeah, you should have, but it's not prejudicial. Doesn't that, in effect, overrule Jackson? I dissented, so I understand your argument, but where we held that that's not for us, that's for the jury to decide, and we can't put ourselves in the place of the jury and decide what's reasonable.
I don't think it has the effect of overruling Jackson. I think it has the effect except to the extent that in Jackson the court said we're just going to presume prejudice and not look at the facts. I think to that degree, yes, it would on the prejudice analysis. And I am asking the court to take another look at Jackson and to reconcile what the court perceived as an inconsistency between the facts of the case and the presumption of prejudice, which the court decided not to reconcile at that point. But so, yes, to a certain degree, I think I am asking the court to back away from Jackson's absolute presumption and to instead look at the facts of the case and judicially determine whether there's prejudice. And I think that this is not anything new. Courts do this all the time. We do it in the post-conviction context under Strickland. We do it in the context
of... But aren't there certain types of error that we just think are more important? I mean, juries, instructional error is just different. There's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. There's all sorts of heightened burdens on the state when we're talking about jury instructions.
Right, Your Honor. There are different types of errors that are treated differently by courts. And for instance, if there is a constitutional error, a violation of the defendant's constitutional right, the state generally carries the burden of proving that that error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I suppose the court could say, well, anytime there's instructional error, the state needs to either prove it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or the state can't prove anything. It just has to be a presumed error that's prejudicial, and there's no further analysis. But I don't think, I think there are all kinds of instructional errors that we subject to a prejudice analysis.
Explain why instructing down once is different than instructing down twice.
Sure. I think instructing down once, the danger that has been identified when you instruct down once, as the court explained in Beck versus Alabama, the United States Supreme Court, there's a concern that, a jury confronted with an option between finding the defendant guilty of, the charged offense and acquittal may not be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is in fact guilty, but perceives a great injustice in entering an acquittal because that means the defendant simply walks away. And so the jury under those circumstances is more inclined to enter the conviction even if it harbors doubts. And this creates unreliability in the verdict. However, in a situation where the jury has been presented with a third option, in addition to conviction on the greater offense and acquittal, in other words, an included offense in the middle, our court has found in a line of cases, which admittedly predate Jackson, that there is no prejudice from the failure to submit yet another included offense because the jury already was given an option and had the ability to find the defendant guilty of the middle option if it was harboring doubts about the charged offense.
But the greater offense and the middle offense, neither one tested the element of recklessness, which was in the instruction that was refused.
In Frost, and in some cases that have cited Frost, that's been the analysis, and there's been discussion along those lines. I think, though, for a couple of reasons, Frost should be reexamined. First, let me talk about my second reason first. I think that the option to acquit in every case always tests the elements of the greater offense. Because if the jury is, in fact, not convinced of one of those elements, it can always acquit. And so there is a testing that occurs of every element because of the option to acquit. So even if there is no lesser offense that tests each individual element, there's always the general testing that comes through the acquittal. Now, when you have the additional testing that comes through the submission of an included offense in the middle, you have maybe specific testing of one or maybe more elements of the greater offense. In those instances, you have both the general testing that comes from the acquittal and the specific testing of any of the elements that are tested by the included offense. I don't think that there should be a requirement that every element of the greater offense be tested before the court finds that there's reliability in the jury's verdict, particularly since in the ordinary course, we presume that the jury follows the law. And so we ordinarily presume that the jury would not have entered that conviction on the greater offense unless it was convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. However, as I said, and as this court has cited Beck versus Alabama for the proposition, there are times when we're concerned that the jury's practice will diverge from theory. And so in those cases, it's important to have a third option that provides additional testing. Now, for instance, in Frost, the defendant was, the jury was instructed on murder in second degree, voluntary manslaughter, but not instructed on involuntary manslaughter. Frost looked at that and said, well, the two instructions that were submitted both submitted the same mental state and didn't submit reckless. And so there really wasn't a test of the mental state of knowingly. I think, though, that that there was a test of the mental state of knowingly in Frost. It may not have been the same test that would have been presented to the jury if reckless had been submitted, but the mental state for knowingly under murder in the first degree was not under the influence of sudden passion. The only way to go down in that case was to find that it was under the influence of sudden passion, in other words, that it was a mitigated mental state. And so the lesser included offense that was submitted in Frost did test the firmness of the jury's belief that the defendant acted knowingly and not under the influence of sudden passion.
Can conduct be not under the influence of sudden passion but reckless?
Yes. And I think that in Frost, the reason why the court reached the conclusion it did was not illogical. And if the court is not going to reexamine Frost, I think that Frost is still distinguishable from the facts that we have in this case. In Frost, the defendant's claim, like here, was that the defendant acted in self-defense. But here's the difference. In Frost, the evidence was, and the evidence that supported the jury's verdict on murder in the second degree was that the defendant knowingly caused the victim's death by stabbing, right? Now, the court observed in Frost that the very same evidence that showed that he knowingly caused the death by stabbing would also support a finding that he recklessly, in imperfect self-defense, caused the victim's death. Because when you act in self-defense, albeit imperfectly, you are still acting with that purpose to cause the person's death because you are trying to protect yourself. And so the exact same evidence that supported the conviction for murder in the second degree also would have supported, perhaps equally, a finding of recklessness based on imperfect self-defense.
And here, wouldn't the exact same evidence of kicking the person depend upon his state of mind, whether he was kicking him in order to kill him, kicking him in order to hurt him, but did it wreck her, but did it recklessly, or whether it was done under sudden passion?
Perhaps, but the difference here is that the evidence that the jury apparently credited and that supported the verdict on the greater offense of murder in the second degree was that the defendant kicked and strangled the victim. So that evidence, unlike in Frost, would not similarly support the conviction of recklessly causing the victim's death merely by kicking, solely by kicking, which is what the defendant submitted in this case.
Unless you adhere to Jackson, which says the jury can believe, disbelieve, all that language, et cetera.
No, I think on the prejudice analysis, we've moved away from Jackson, because the Jackson analysis is focused on whether there was error. Okay. There was error. But when you move to the prejudice analysis, we're not operating on what could the jury have done. We know what the jury did in this case.
But here his argument was that he did kick her. He did not strangle her. He left her, and she was alive, and that he didn't intend to kill her, but the jury may not have believed that. But they may have decided that he really didn't, but he was so reckless in injuring her that she died.
Which is precisely why
the trial court erred. Why didn't the jury have that option? Yeah.
But that's why the trial court erred in not giving the instruction. But it doesn't answer the question whether there was prejudice, because prejudice operates from the starting position of, this is what the jury found. The jury's verdict indicates that it believed beyond a reasonable doubt that he caused the victim's death knowingly, both by kicking and strangling. So the question is, under the Frost analysis, would that evidence of knowingly causing her death by kicking and strangling also support the defendant's claim that is it reasonably probable the jury would have instead found, well, no, he really just recklessly caused her death by kicking her?
So we should assume that if the jury believed the death was simply caused by kicking, the jury would have acquitted.
Well, I think so, because that was always an option, and the state took upon itself the burden.
Even if the jury thought that he caused the death by kicking, the jury would have been compelled to acquit on the second-degree murder.
Well, if the jury harbored doubts about the defendant's guilt of murder in the second degree, then a rational jury would perhaps still enter a conviction rather than an acquittal. But here, it stands to reason that they would have entered their conviction on the lesser option available to it rather than the greater.
But what if they didn't believe there was sudden passion? You're saying they should have done it anyway.
But we're operating from the assumption that they weren't following the law, right? If that's our beginning point, then why would they, I think the question becomes, why would they pick the greater one instead of the lesser one if they're harboring doubts about the greater one? If they're harboring doubts about the greater, but they don't want to acquit, logic says, well, we're gonna walk it down to the middle option.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I think the respondent's argument highlights why Jackson found that prejudice would be presumed, because to weigh prejudice requires a lot of assumptions and speculations. Would the jury have convicted him of involuntary manslaughter? We don't know, because that was not before them. If they're presumed to follow the instructions, they had two instructions in front of them, neither of which tested recklessness.
Your opponent says that not every element of the greater offense should be tested. Do you agree with that statement?
That not every element of the greater? I think that runs counter to Jackson. I think every element should be tested if it's requested by the defense, which it was in this case. And again, for further speculation, if a jury thinks he did cause her death and the two options in front of it are murder in the second degree and voluntary manslaughter, it may not be comfortable just acquitting him. And it may have gone with whichever option it felt best supported their verdict, but that doesn't mean they wouldn't have convicted him of involuntary manslaughter. They may not have been comfortable with a straight acquittal, but we don't know that. All of this is making assumptions and speculating about facts, which is counter to what Jackson and Pierce and Randall and Roberts and the many recent cases out of this court have established. And again, even if it is a rebuttable presumption, I think in this particular case, Mr. Sanders put on substantial evidence of reckless conduct. And he had his own testimony, and he had that of the witness in the room that supported that. And I don't think that's required for any defendant, but certainly in Mr. Sanders' case, there was substantial evidence that he acted recklessly. And I think to hold counter would be to really undermine the holdings of Jackson and Pierce, that when it comes to the facts and what to believe from the facts, that should always be left to the jury or to the fact finder. And I don't think this case is at all distinguishable from Frost. Very same facts. She argued that she acted in self-defense. It's kind of an imperfect self-defense case, and the court found prejudice in that case. And I would ask this court to continue to uphold the findings of Jackson and Pierce, and it should not assume that there was a just and proper verdict when the jury was improperly instructed. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted.